Welcome, everybody, to the Dyslexically Successful podcast. I'm so excited to share the stories of these individuals, their stories of triumph and encouragement and inspiration to move through some really challenging things in their lives, whether it is learning to read or even just graduating from school, getting a job, being able to find their strengths that they have within them to be successful. And absolutely, I want to foster an understanding that their success is not in spite of their dyslexia, but it is because of it. And so I'm so glad to have you listening to these stories today. So today on Dyslexically Successful, we will be speaking with Sarah Vickery. Sarah has a great story to share with you because I remember growing up in high school and not exactly knowing what I wanted to do. And even in college, a lot of my friends had no idea what they wanted to be or where their interests lie for a career. And I think there's a lot of pressure we put on our kids, maybe in fear that they won't be able to figure it out. But Sarah is a perfect example of how even when you think you have it figured out, you can always choose a different path. So I'm very excited to welcome Sarah Vickery to the program and to learn all about her cartoon club and how that came to be.
Well, welcome everyone to Moonchild Radio. Today I have a very special guest with me, Sarah Vickery, and she's going to talk with us today about how she got to be where she is today and her exciting cartoon club. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks, Christine. It's great to talk with you today.
Fantastic. Say, where are you from? You're not from the United States.
No, I'm not from the United States. Originally, I'm from Toronto, Canada, but I made a bit of a, well, quite a big career change back in 2012. And because my dad is English, I also have British citizenship. So, and I always had this thing in my head where I wanted to come over to the UK just to do something. But when I was gonna do my career change, I thought, well, I'll go back to school in the UK. So that's how now I live in the UK. And originally I was in London when I was studying, but since then I've moved out to an area that's about, well, sort of like commuter distance to London called Guildford, so in the Surrey Hills. So that's where I'm talking to you from, my studio there.
That's wonderful. You know, I have a connection to London. I was a surrogate in 2018 and my dads who have the baby live in London.
Oh my God, amazing.
Yeah, so one day I'll go and visit them. He's two now, so.
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty cool. Well, thanks for talking with me. And, you know, on Moonchild Radio, I really want to get into who you are today. But before we get there, tell me about you growing up and kind of, I don't know, did you feel like you were different than other kids or did you feel like your creativity, how did that develop?
It was always there from the start. So I definitely felt like I was different than other children when I was young. I guess I noticed it the most when I started school. So that was, you know, in Canada, we start when you're about five when you start school. And I was a little bit young because I was born in November. But I always felt like, a little bit on the outside. You know, kids would be playing games and I had a hard time joining in or understanding the fun in a lot of games. I really gravitated towards working on my own and like exploring things on my own. I really like to be on my own, like drawing. I like to be on my own, building forts and stuff outside with animals. That was a big thing as well. So just me and we had a dog at the time. So just me and the dogs. I had a real focus on drawing and doing creative things. Like I sewed, I used to sew a lot. So anything like that. And with playing with other children, for me, it was always more kind of one-on-one. So I was really great that way. If I had a friend, I would be playing sort of like a game that I would sort of set up and imagine, like a doll type game or whatever, but a game one-on-one. Or with my sister, I'd invite her to, can we color together, Hope? Or can we build this fort for my toads or something, this type of thing. So in that sense, yeah, that I did feel different and a bit on the outside.
That's interesting. Now, that was who you were. So a lot of times as parents or even as adults, we think to ourselves, well, we must be involved with friends. We must learn how to socialize. Do you have a sense that you must do that, or that was just the way you were and you were okay with it?
Probably a bit of both. I definitely felt like that's the way I was. But I did also feel the sense that particularly the draw to make really good friends, because I saw it with my sister, because my sister was much more verbal than me. Like I didn't speak I don't remember what age I started speaking, but I was about a year past my sister starting speaking. And my mother said that she couldn't get me to say a single word. You know, kids usually start by saying, she couldn't get me to say a single word. And then one day I just started speaking in complete sentences. And she said she almost fell off her chair.
Mm-hmm.
Says that I think because my sister was older, she may have done a lot of the talking for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I got the feeling because of seeing my sister as an example and her my sister being very like verbally intelligent, and seeing how she made friends easily and was, really had a really great social kind of group in that. I wanted that as well, but I didn't quite know how to go about doing it.
So you had that sense of, like, you could see that example of what your sister was, but you didn't quite know how to get there to make that connection.
Yeah.
That's really interesting about the language. Yeah. Children are going to be saying their first words around one. And by the age of two, we would expect 50 words and saying two words together. So that didn't really happen for you. So that is one of the soft signs for dyslexia. So you do have that diagnosis or that label.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did that come about that you learned you were dyslexic?
I was an adult when I learned, because when I was young, in my school, they didn't diagnose those types of learning difficulties back then, And all they did was, the thing was, I had this grade 1-2 teacher who I thought was amazing because she really liked me and she'd let me draw and paint and color all day long. And she'd give me really good report cards, even though I couldn't spell or read or do anything. And I had her for, like I said, both years, grades 1 and 2. And so by the time I got to grade 3 and I got a new teacher, she discovered that I couldn't read and I couldn't spell and all of this. And that's when I got put into the remedial class. So basically they just had sort of a slow learner's class and you just got kind of shuffled into that. And then they kept trying to teach us by phonics, I think, to read, which still never clicked with me. I remember my sister even trying to help me. My mom tried to help me, but I couldn't get it. Anyways, I remember distinctly like being in that class. I was in it for, I don't know how long, probably a few months. And I remember the day I was in that class and the teacher who was there, it wasn't my normal teacher, it was a specific teacher. But my regular teacher came in and she opened the door and she said, I don't think Sarah needs to be in here any longer, because I had sort of figured out this way. All of a sudden everything had clicked and I'd figured out how to read. So I was the one answering all of the questions. I went from saying nothing, like zero. I was very quiet as a child. So I went from saying nothing to all of a sudden answering like reading. But I think what I had done is I'd sort of figured out how it was that I was able to read, which was by seeing the word as a picture, right? So after the teacher had said it enough and I'd visually seen the word enough, I knew what the word was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I got taken back out of the remedial class. And then by my next year, by grade 4, I was way ahead. Mm-hmm. And they almost had wanted to advance me when I got into those grades, but luckily that didn't happen. But
so I think that's orthographic mapping, when you can like imprint that that word. I mean, that's how we all learn words, but I think with your visual strengths, it might have taken longer to get there, but then as soon as it did, you got that. And yeah. So auditorily, to learn it through phonics was really hard for you, because yeah. that pathway of being able to hear a sound and hold on to that meaning was not there.
No, it was not there. It was not yeah. there at all.
Yeah. So that's,
I even relied on that going forward, because it was like there was nothing I dreaded more than having to read out loud in class. Mm-hmm. And my mother used to help me at night by having me read out loud. It was so difficult for me. So the only way, and one of the ways that I made really good friends, is I'd be Sarah reading class. I'd start down and I'd have somebody sitting beside me. Often it was my friend Monica. And she'd hear me reading along, and then she'd know that I'd get to the word that I didn't know what it was. And she'd just whisper it to me, you know? So that's, or somebody would whisper it to me, someone would say it. And then by that happening enough, that's how I was able to read.
So that's a resource for you, and so incredible to have that naturally. Nobody set that up for you. That naturally happened. And I think obviously there are definitely children who don't have resources like that to help them along, but it sounded like the peer network that you did have was very supportive of you and really yeah. did help you. You used it as a crutch for what you needed it for,
yeah.
But that helped you kind of get over that hump. I also had a similar experience as far as not wanting to read aloud in class. Can you tell me more about that? Like, what happened, if you remember, what happened in your body, or like if you can take yourself back to...
It was just absolute, it was just dread. It was dread because it was the relief of my teachers, her looking at me, and then her seeing maybe I think she would actually see the fear on my face, like, don't choose me. And her saying, oh, you know, Michelle, your turn. I'd be like, oh, thank goodness. It was like this sigh of relief. The same thing would happen with having to do, like when we started to have to do like a little presentation in class or something, the same incredible level of fear. It's the fear also of being judged. Like, I was so afraid, because everyone could do this quite easily, even, you know, because I didn't feel like I was a stupid person, but I thought when people hear me trying to read, they're going to think I'm a stupid person. That was almost the feeling.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who can't see us, Sarah is taking her hands up to her chest often. So that's where our throat chakra is. And so our throat chakra is going to be storing a lot of energy around being able to express your truth. And I wonder too, is that where you felt that sensation of like, you couldn't get out?
Yes. And it was the same thing with like other just social interactions, is I felt like, I felt tongue-tied. Mm-hmm. I felt tongue-tied. And that's why, like for me, like if you'll see me, I often also have a pen in my hand. Like it's almost like a safety net, because if I could draw something, I could express myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also how I got the reward from the drawing, because even though it started off as something that I did just for myself and very like hidden, you know, like I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, sneak downstairs before everyone was up, and I'd grab my sketchbook and I would draw cartoons. That's what I would do. And my mom would come down at about 6 o'clock or so. Like I was probably up at 5:15 or 5:30. My mom would come down about 6 or 6:15, and she'd walk by and she'd be like, what are you doing? So I'm like, I'm busy. And I was drawing, right? I was drawing because that was easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same thing in school, when, I mean, even as young as junior kindergarten, I remember the teacher saying, like when your parents would pick you up, come on in, Mrs. Vickery, and look at the painting Sarah's done or something.
Mm-hmm. So that intrinsic motivation, like what 5-year-old or 6-year-old is getting themselves up at 5:15 to draw, but that was so strong for you. That was such an internal, so that's important. How do you develop that in someone who doesn't have that?
How do you develop that in someone who doesn't?
For instance, you couldn't like say to your child, you need to wake up at 5 to draw, but yet that was a outlet for you that, well, one was preparation for who you are today in hindsight, but also a stress reliever. It gave you, it was another resource for you. It was something that you did for you only.
So
how does one find that?
I think that, I think you can try, if it's not drawing, it will be something else. Or maybe it's something else artistic. Maybe it's painting, maybe it's coloring, maybe it's sewing. But whatever the thing is, I think it speaks to you quite quickly, because when you do it, you get the feeling like you're processing your thoughts, and that your thoughts are, they're not spinning anymore, and you don't feel the fear or the anxiety. You feel, okay, I get this. And then there's a feeling of stepping along through things versus feeling stuck and feeling stifled and feeling like you're not expressing. So I think it's the feeling like that you're feeling that expression be processed.
That's a really great way of describing it. And I would imagine that listeners of this show often do feel stuck in processes, or if not right now, maybe in the past, and maybe you're avoiding something because you don't like that feeling of being stuck. And so wonderful that you can use drawing. But like you said, I mean, I think, you know, being able to kind of just explore, and you said you did many things, the independent play, the sewing, like you kind of explored and dabbled in a lot of different ways to express yourself, and the drawing was the one that stuck out to you naturally.
Yes, the drawing was the one that stuck out to me naturally. And I think you also get that because other people will recognize it in you. So that's what would happen in school. Like when I was, you know, when I didn't show, before I showed my art, or before many people would see it in school or other things, you do it on your own. So you don't have a comparison. You don't have a gauge so much. You gauge by yourself. Am I getting better? But then as soon as other people start seeing things, you start to realize that, oh, this is a difference in me. Like I pay more attention to this, or I notice things, or the way that I explore things visually is different from the way other people explore things. For example, like I was so worried because I think it was about grade 4 or 5. And this is when I had caught up in the reading and those types of things. I was doing well in school. And I was also doing well in math and other areas as well. But I remember one day getting called to the principal's office, and they didn't tell me why. I was called to the principal's office at the end of the day, and they had called my mother in. And I remember sitting there, I was so worried. And it turns out, and they had told me to bring down some of my work in that. And the principal had called my mother into the school, but to show him some of my artwork.
Wonderful. But that was anxiety though for you, that the fact that your mom was coming to school, what was she being called for? But it was
It was something good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was both, because it's like you're slightly embarrassed at being pointed out, but you're sort of proud as well. So, but that also, I don't know, it made me think maybe this is a good thing about me. Maybe I should focus a bit more on it.
I like that. So, okay. So I think that a lot of kids and adults, when they do realize a difference, maybe aren't so sure that it's a good thing, and then repress that or hold back there, or are doubting themselves. Judgment plays a big role, being able to start, when you start having that self-judgment and then fear of what other people will think, can definitely could stifle some of this, but you loved it so much and you got so much benefit from it that it didn't matter then at that point.
Yes and no, it still takes, I mean, and I see this in classes that I teach too. There's a big difference in doing art for yourself and keeping it to yourself and showing it to other people. Mm. So that is a big stage, I find, as well, like a big step, I should say, because for a long time, you know, my sketchbooks were very private. I didn't want to, there were certain things, like if I did a certain piece and I'd be like, this is for me to show people. So there'd be certain things that I would show to people, but the rest I would keep very private. Because a lot of it was processing my thoughts or things that I would imagine or things that I would want, you know, my, like some of my dreams and ideas. So that part of my artwork, I kept really private. I remember even, it was probably not until high school when I had an amazing art teacher. Her name was Mrs. Crawford, and she was so good. And I don't think I really knew how good she was at the time. You know, you don't always recognize how good a teacher you have until after that. Anyway, she was terrific, but it was in her class that we started to have to sort of present our artwork and talk about it and talk about the meaning. So there it was, combining the visual and showing your ideas and talking in front of others.
And you could do that.
It took time, but I could do it. It was actually sort of surprising, because even though I, like I said, wouldn't consider myself to be linguistically strong, I actually started doing French immersion in Canada in grade 7. So they had a special program, enriched program, for kids to do it starting in grade 7 as opposed to junior kindergarten. I got into that program, and it was a group of like just terrific, terrific kids and teachers. Okay, so I was really lucky to have both. And we had good art teachers, but also, you know, the language was stressed as well. But one of the things we had to do was speech arts. I guess everyone has to do speech arts, but because we were very, you know, we had a lot of focus on language, and we, you know, we'd even do presentations in French and that, but our speech arts was in English. And I remember I was so dreading doing speech arts because of, you know, how I was always someone who would like trip over the words and that. But I sort of, I did this one speech. I partnered up with one of my friends, and we were going to present this. It was like a poem, a really long poem, and we were going to present it together. And I was really, really nervous about doing it. And any presentations that I had done up to that point, I was not good. So it's like nobody really thought that when Michelle and I were going to do our presentation or our speech, that it was going to be any good. We wound up winning speech arts. Oh. So we went through several levels and we went on to the next level competition. And I remember thinking, I'm like, I was really surprised I could do it. But I think part of it was because I was doing it with Michelle. And Michelle was, she was a sports person. And so she's like, when we were practicing, she would say to me, she would coach me, because she had always been coached, okay? So she would coach me, she'd be like, no, you need to do like this action, and you need to do this with me, and I'm going to do this action, then you respond with this, and we'd go back and forth. And so we had this sort of speaking conversation, but also like a moving conversation. Mm-hmm. And we had to memorize. She's like, no, we have to memorize it. And she had all these, you know, rules. So that's how I learned. I think I discovered a bit of a way of how I had to be able to present and you know, be able to speak in front of people. So
how wonderful. So I see this all the time as a pediatric physical therapist. Not every child understands how to move their body a certain way, but as soon as we show them or coach them, they've got it.
Oh,
and I would imagine that the same was for you for speech. Like your brain naturally didn't figure this out, but then as you were coached, you got it.
Yeah.
So that's so important. So many things that you're saying, I think about parents and how we, potentially unknowingly stifle our kids, or like even in drawing. I have three children, and I am really, my middle son is very talented as far as drawing goes, and I want to encourage him to do that, but I think I might stop him in the sense that I want to see what he's doing. Like maybe if it is just something private for him, something that he just develops on his own, he'll want to do it more as opposed to thinking that he would have to show this to me when he's done. Like that might be anxiety producing enough, and I totally understand that anxiety. And you almost, whatever ability you do have, which you have a lot of abilities, but you almost like you put up this wall, you block yourself from accessing it with that anxiety. but yeah. you don't see a way out because all you see is the stop in that process. So you have your pen to as a resource. You had lots of friends who were resources. You had your drawing that was that private resource. And so then talk to me about like high school and college and like how did you shift into your first career and then shift?
Well, it was, I mentioned that amazing art teacher I had in high school, Mrs. Crawford. So anyways, that's how I started to actually get to be good at making presentations. It's because I had in my head from speech arts, having, you know, been able to, I'm like, I gained the confidence that I could do it from speech arts. So then in art class, I started to understand, and she really rewarded me, like me and everyone else, being able to present their ideas and really sort of assess them and also take feedback from other people. So I started to gain the confidence to be able to like present and do that. And she really was encouraging me to go on in art. So for university to go and do art. And I was starting to feel like I was completely divided because I was really strong in math and science and I liked it. And I was strong in art. Okay. So I was divided between going to school to OCA, which is Ontario College of Art, and studying art, or doing something else, which was actually engineering. So I actually took, I did a portfolio, I put together my portfolio, she helped me, and I went to the the pre sort of portfolio evaluation day where some of the teachers from the university are there and they look at your portfolio and give you feedback. And I just felt wrong going. My parents went with me, just something felt very awkward and wrong. And like, I don't know, I didn't feel like I fit in there. It didn't feel like that was what I was supposed to do for some reason, even though I really, really wanted to go on and do art. And I also had a real, real passion for animals and horses in particular. And I wanted a horse. And I know this sounds like a crazy thing, but I thought, well, if I get a more practical job like engineering, you know, if I study engineering, I know I'll get a job, I can get my horse, and I can, you know, do drawing in my spare time. And this was sort of, that was the extent of my, you know, my reasoning. We didn't have great guidance in high school, but I remember when I told my art teacher this, I said, no, I'm decided I'm going to go, I'm going to do engineering. She's like, my husband's an engineer. She says, you're not going to like it. Do you want to know what? She's right. I did not like it.
That's okay though. But you listened to your intuition. Did your parents have a sway in that? Were they also more pro engineering, or they kind of left it up to you?
Well, I mean, they did leave it up to me, but it just seemed like the more practical thing to do. And university is expensive, you know, it was expensive. They didn't pressure me to, you know, to go one way or the other. My dad is an engineer, and actually all kinds of my relatives are engineers. So it also kind of runs in the family in certain ways. Like, I also think that way. I do think very logically and problem solving. And I do, you know, I can do that stuff as well. So I had a really hard time in university. I mean, I did fine in my studies, but it was, there was no art. I didn't do any art for at least 2 years, zero. And I remember it being my third year university, and I had a horse magazine. I didn't have a horse at that time, but I was just doing a little tiny bit of riding, and I would indulge myself by having horse magazines. And to me, like, horses are so visually rich. Like, that was part of the real, you know, thing for me. And I was sitting there and I was taking a break from studying, and I picked up my pencil and I started just sort of like looking at this horse photograph and drawing it. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot I used to like get so much pleasure from drawing.
Oh wow.
And that's when I started doing a bit of drawing again.
So for 2 years, what do you think happened to your psyche or to your, like, did that change significantly during those 2 years as far as how you were able to manage difficult things?
Yeah, I mean, because I guess it's like when you're in any situation, like, you really feel like you, well, me in that, in university, the first 2 years, like they scare you, because in the, your first talk from the dean or whatever, he says, look to your right, look to your left. Only one of you is going to be here in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And they're not kidding in engineering at Queen's. It's horrendously hard. So you get this sort of, get go into this panic mode where all of my energy, I'm like, I have to focus everything on my studies or I'm going to fail. So that's what I did. I just focused on it. And that, you know, and I did the, like, exercising was my only way of, you know, my only outlet to, like, to get through it. So that's sort of how I cope. But it, I guess it also probably made it really not very fun, you know?
Right. But, you know, thinking about that, so if we are in survival mode, which it sounds like for at least for those first 2 years or for partially those first 2 years, you were just like, you had to do it regardless. Yeah. And if you feel that that need to survive or protect yourself, you can't be safe and social. So you can't be playing, you can't be exploring.
No.
So it was just, and it's really hard to access your cognitive brain. Obviously, if you're in engineering, you had a lot of things that you knew, but I wonder, just out of curiosity, if you, I mean, you don't know this, but if you would have had a little bit more drawing or freedom, I wonder if your studies would have felt easier.
Probably. And the other thing was, is I didn't really have any artsy friends because I was in engineering and I was just friends with other engineers. I didn't, you don't have time. You're in, because we have so much, so many hours of class. So you're in class with engineers and then you're studying. So that, and then your friends are engineers because you need help from them. You need to all work together and help each other out. And so that, that is, makes the circle even smaller. It makes your world even smaller and tighter. So, and I do remember, because my first year I was in a dorm. So there were people in other disciplines. And a few doors down, there were a couple of girls, and one was in art and another one was in something else. But I remember being this little twinge of jealousy for this girl who was doing art. I'm like, but I didn't have time to explore it or be, you know, do it myself. But yeah, that's what happened. So
right. It's interesting. Again, you can't, hindsight is 20/20, but I think we can survive like that, but only for a finite amount of time.
Yeah.
So then you graduated from university and you started working as an engineer, I'm imagining.
Yes, but not for very long. So I had two engineering jobs. So I did an internship between my third and fourth year university, and I did an engineering job. And that's when I got my horse, because that was my goal. And then I graduated and I did another engineering job. And I worked at what was Spar Aerospace on the Canada arm. So it was a pure engineering job, you know? So it wasn't, there was no, like, I thought, oh, I can get into an engineering job and lean towards business in it, or I have one of these, you know, one of these sort of semi-engineering jobs. But I wound up in a real, real engineering job and engineering environment. And well, I really enjoyed being around the people, because you're around a lot of really smart people. There was just this big gap. So it almost exaggerated it more to me that I was missing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that all switched, and I studied again, and I wound up, and I moved into working in financial services and for a stockbroker, which is something completely different again.
So what was that experience like?
That was a real eye-opener, because I spent so many years, you know, well, my university years in engineering with engineering type people who are not creative. And I shouldn't say, that's a sweeping statement. They're oftentimes very analytical, they tend to be a certain mindset, and they're oftentimes, you don't need super strong social skills either. But when I moved into financial services and started working for this portfolio manager, I had to really, really, really get myself up to speed in terms of even basic phone skills, customer service skills, talking to people, I had none of this. I was terrible. I can't believe I wasn't fired. I was like, I was so lucky because my coworker, she'd been doing the same job. We were doing the same job. She had been doing it for over a decade when I started working with her, and she was very, 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 very skilled. So I just was like a sponge copying everything that she did to try and get up to speed.
She was like your Monica or your other friend in grade school and high school. So again, I'm hearing about these resources, the resources to help you fill in the gaps.
Yes.
And so we can find those. They may not be right there offering their assistance, but we can definitely find resources to help us fill in the gap, whether that's independent study, reading books, podcasts, a friend at work, a coworker. So that's really important. Especially for those who are neurodivergent, who think a little bit differently, some of that stuff just doesn't come naturally to us. Yeah. My husband has been my biggest resource because I'm not even aware of the quirky little things that I do, or the things that I'm missing, the lack of eye contact, or the unintentional divergent to talk about myself and not come back to the other person. Those are things that just don't come to my head. So you need that external structure.
Yes. I had the exact same thing. And that's why also I think when I was young, a lot of other kids thought I didn't like them, but it was because I was nervous around them because I didn't know the normal way of being normally social, if you will. Making small talk, and that was really difficult for me. So with my coworker, Michelle, I mean, she was so good at it. You know, she'd know everybody just by the sound of their voice. She would know, she'd remember that, their child was coming back from university. She would remember all these little details about, that stuff didn't register with me. I would make notes. It was me, and I'd write things down, and that's how I would, try and do my little bit. So it was difficult.
That's nice though, that you were able to have that resource. At the time, did you recognize that as helpful, or were you annoyed that she was that way, or?
Oh no, I recognized it as helpful, but I also recognized, it reminded me of a lot of things that my mother would be telling me, Sarah, when you're on the phone, you need to, she would try to coach me in these. And when it's your parent saying it, you're like, nah, you don't want to hear it from them. But when I was in a work environment and it was Michelle telling me, or not, she wasn't even telling me, I just mimicked her. Like I just tried to mimic her. I just tried to use her as an example. So in some ways she was very good because she wasn't preachy. She didn't, she didn't tell me I was doing it wrong. She just did it right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that also gives us some insight, parents, that we can teach through example.
Yeah.
And I think we often think that the only way to teach is by saying, this is what you do. But to be a really good model and consistent with our behavior, especially I'm thinking about screen time, you can't be on the phone and be trying to engage with your child. Like you wouldn't want them to do that to you. So really helping support your kids where they struggle, but by being that model for them, not always just reprimanding, because that was what you picked up on. And over time, I mean, it might not happen as fast as we want it to, but we know that if you're a neurodivergent learner, we do take that longer path, but that's going to help us get there. So let's go on to the big change into saying no to all of that and returning back to your passion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I worked in that job for a long time. So I was there for 13 or almost only 14, 13 years anyways. And then, so it was about 2012 and earlier in that time, I'd just been getting this feeling like I got to the point where I knew my job, I was good at my job, I was really close with my coworkers, and it was all fine, but there was something missing. And I had started, I always loved design. Like I'd renovated a house, and you know, so I'd done lots of design work, renovating the house. I always loved that stuff, and worked along with my dad doing that. So I really liked that. And when the house renovation was done, I decided that it was time to start doing something artistic again. And because I hadn't even been doing very much drawing. Like the drawing would have was like design drawing, and you know that. So I'd always wanted to paint watercolors. So I got myself this set of watercolors, and I had an easel, and I started taking a few rather like beginner type watercolor courses. I had such a hard time. Watercolor is the last thing to start with if you want to get back into art. It's one of the most difficult mediums. Don't start doing watercolor. Pick anything else. Don't pick watercolor. So it was so frustrating, literally. I barely have a temper at all. There were times when I literally would throw my brush across the room. Like, can I throw my brush? Anyways, I pursued painting watercolor, and I still do that. So, and I started to want to, I remember saying to my friend, Jen, I said, I'm painting all these watercolors. And this was when Facebook was starting to get a little bit more popular. I said, is it funny if I post some of my paintings on Facebook? Will people think that's weird, or I don't know. So I was sort of getting this feeling like I wanted to transition from doing it just for me to showing some of my stuff. And somehow it felt like I was supposed to be doing it for some other people. And then I had some friends starting to buy a few paintings from me. So that was another thing that made me think, maybe I should do this something. I don't know, I need to do something more as my work. But I didn't think it was paintings. I thought, well, you don't really, how are you supposed to make a job out of painting? I don't know if that was quite it. So I decided I'll go for something a little bit more practical. So I sort of did a hybrid. I decided I'm going to go back to school for interior design. I'm going to study design because I thought that'll incorporate some of like my engineering kind of mind, plus my drawing, and it's creative, and I'll do it in England. I thought I'll go, you know, I've always had this feeling like I needed to come here and explore, just spend time. So I thought that's a great combination. And I felt like I needed to make a big change too. And still, I didn't have that many artsy creative friends. I thought, you know, that there's history and watercolor painting and art and design in England, like it's a real cultural center for that. So I thought, then I'll feel more immersive. And I wanted a real kind of shakeup, you know, in terms of that. So that's how I wound up coming over here and studying at a design school in London. So that's how it all kind of came about.
That's a big change. How was your family with you like leaving Canada?
Yeah, they were, you know, sad to see me go and all that, but my parents are very accepting of if it feels like the right thing, that's good, you know. I think they were happy for me if it was going to be something good for me. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it felt like that, you know. It wasn't the thing, which is all right, but it was a really, because it was a very intensive kind of course in that. So in hindsight, like, well, I don't work in interior design. It was a really necessary kind of shakeup, and being around those types of really creative people, that made a big difference. And I had to get all my skills up to speed. I didn't have all of the design computer skills and all of this type of thing. And you know, just getting back into like really keeping a sketchbook and it being, you know, a big part of what I did daily versus a hobby.
Right. That's interesting. I think too, the support, your resources, that a lot of times when we are afraid to do something, or if our parents are afraid that we're going to turn out as failures, they try to control so much that it almost like we turn out as failures. Like it's like what you're trying to avoid is what actually manifests because of, I guess, all that resistance that would have, if your parents would have made you like, no, you can't leave us, or you can't go back to school, or that's not practical, or just really would have I mean, obviously you were a grown woman, you have your own decision making, but trying to take you out of where you felt you needed to grow. It's almost like we wear a certain size shoe as a kid. And when your parents go and buy shoes, they always buy that next size up because they know you're going to grow into it. They don't keep you in the same size shoe. So I'm happy to hear that your parents were so supportive throughout all your decisions of what you were going to do for your career. And I think that as if you're a parent out there listening, to reflect on that and reflect on how we can create space for our kids to grow and be safe and social and explore and play and find that connection. So then you made a business that helped support kids in this too, right?
Yes. So basically, yeah. So I finished design school and I thought I'm not supposed to work in interior design. I just kept gravitating back to my own artwork. So I started doing a lot more painting in that. And then what happened was I moved further out of London and I wound up moving in and renting a room from my friend Veronica. And the room was carpeted, so I couldn't paint. And I thought, I guess I'm gonna draw. I guess I'll get back to doing more drawing because I can't paint, I can't make a mess in here because the way I paint is vertical. So I started doing more drawing and I started, that's where you see some of my cards in the background. So that's when I started doing cards. So I thought I want something that's not like a product, but something that, you know, where my drawing reaches people. So I started doing that. I started teaching drawing classes too, not a lot, but a little bit of drawing classes. And I was also doing some other sort of part-time, consulting type things to keep my income going. And then that just started to go down and I just started focusing more and more on my artwork. And it was a couple things happened. I hadn't been doing, like I said, I was doing more illustration-y type work, more realistic type stuff. And I got back into the cartooning because I'm also very interested in health and well-being. And I started drawing these cartoons all based on different well-being and health concepts that I would read. So I was doing this little health, cartoon health blog. And then I was working with another woman at the time doing a couple of workshops. And she said, it was half term. And she said, we're going to do this workshop together for half term for some children. And I said, what are we going to do? What's the workshop on? She says, we'll do a design your own cartoon workshop. Design your own cartoon. I thought, well, I have been, I used to draw cartoons all the time. I have been doing this cartoon health book. So, okay. And then another friend of mine who was an illustrator, he said, yeah, I teach cartooning and after schools, it's a math, for some after school clubs, you should teach it at some after school clubs. I thought, really? So I started doing this. And next thing I know, I've been doing this cartoon club. And since lockdown, I've just moved it all online. So yeah, it just kind of happened, but the irony is that, that's what I started off doing was drawing cartoons.
Right. I think that's wonderful that you can circle back around and pick up that passion that what is really intrinsically motivating to you and really makes you happy and be able to share that. So the other thing, I'm as a business owner, I don't hear any sort of business plan that you, it seems like this just naturally organically grew, but yet if you're in a business course or you have to plan about all these things, how did that shift or come together for you?
It was more from, me seeing the types of kids that I was attracting and who wanted to come back to class. And so I do teach both kids and adults. And I started offering some classes and teaching them at one of the local adult learning institutes and seeing the reaction from the adults. And the funniest thing being that what both ends of the spectrum get out of it, and so that's really what made me want to do more of it. and see the value in it is that, like, firstly, like working with the kids, you just see how creative they are. And the way that I teach my classes is that I do the same class for both the children and the adults. It's the identical thing. And every week I have a different topic that I teach. So I come up with something, you know, a little bit, usually there's a juxtaposition, like, or something sort of funny happening. So do you want me to, I can show you my phone.
Sure. Just hold on.
I know anyone who's listening can't see it, but so say I have, like, this was one of my topics, Monster Sound Studio. So I have something where that gets us thinking creatively. And so I present the theme or topic, and then we all brainstorm together and we come up with an idea of how we're going to make our pictures, because I don't go in with something in particular that I'm going to teach you how to draw this monster and these are the steps to doing it. I don't go in like that. It's more about, like, I go in a bit cold. So teaching is actually fairly, it's almost more like performing, because I'm quite on, because I don't have a script, if you will, of what I'm going to do. Because when I'm drawing, children I was seeing are, and can keep coming back, the ones who are very creative thinkers, not necessarily the best drawers. Sometimes I get some very good drawers as well. But sometimes I just get kids who really enjoy the process of the imagination and putting it down on paper. So what I try to do is I be creative with them. So I put myself on the spot, you know, we brainstorm together, like, how are we going to draw this topic? Like, I haven't, you know, I've done research about what I'm going to do, but not about the topic, but not about what I'm going to draw. So by putting myself on the spot, and I talk them through how I'm going to create the particular drawing and the particular story, because we create a narrative. It's about telling a story and exploring a topic. By them seeing me do it, and by seeing me, you know, do things well and stumble at other things, this is how, like, I'm trying to demonstrate to them how you do it, not instruct. So very much what I, you know, would seek out in my mentors.
Right. It sounds very much like your class in high school, your speech and arts class, how it incorporated your drawing, but then being able to talk about the process and the meaning behind and the why behind what you're doing. Yeah. And that connection of meaning is really important, especially for your target audience, those kids who really do think in pictures or who do express themselves creatively through drawing, even if they're not the best drawers. But that's built on that process that you naturally found so successful for you, and sharing that with maybe kids who haven't had that experience yet.
Yeah, because when I do, like, any new child or adult for that matter who comes into class, I say, have you ever done any classes like this before? No, no, no. And I also ask them about, you know, what are you doing in art in school? What are you learning? And well, they're not doing any cartooning, that's for sure. And it's not done in this way. This type of exploration is something that most people are doing on their own. And the thing is, and the one thing that I'm trying to show in my class is that you can be creative on your own, but the best creativity comes from being together and sharing your ideas. And this is why, like, you know, I said, like, a lot of, you know, I myself kept my sketchbooks and everything very private at the start, and kids are allowed to do that. You don't have to show anything. But when everyone sees everyone sharing ideas and gaining ideas from other people, they start to show their work. Mm-hmm. And same with adults. The adults are almost more to the extreme, because a lot of adults I get have not done any drawing in a long, long, long time. And the thing about the cartooning is that, if you call it drawing, like, a lot of people think, oh, drawing, I cannot draw. But if you say, you know, you're going to doodle this, or, you know, like, it's a cartoon, it's just a cartoon, and you see the simplicity of some of the cartoons, people think, okay, yeah, I can do that. And also that sometimes the simpler, the better, and that it's really about the idea. And this is why I'm starting to expand, like, I'm working on a physical game version of my Cartoon Club class, because it's really to show that concept that it's not about, I call it, like, ageless art, you know, it's a game of ageless art for kids and big kids, you know, because when you start doing it, and that's the delight I see in the adults, is that, again, you just feel like a big kid.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's a resource. It has always been a resource for you, and you keep coming back to it. And I think that that's like energy, like in your face, like, hey, wait, this is still here for you. And you had that throughout your life intermittently. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody else did not get a chance to explore or wasn't drawn to that, but yet it would be such a helpful outlet for them to be able to process. And if you don't know that until you kind of get into starting and seeing how it changes you, like, you don't come in, no one's signing up for your class because they want to have a bigger process their thoughts better, but that's what happens.
Yes. Exactly. That's what happens. And that's why I find it interesting to see the people who keep coming back, you know, mm-hmm. and who really enjoy it.
Yeah. So how do we learn more?
Sometimes they're great drawers. Sometimes they're just, you know, average drawers, but that, you know, their thinking is very creative.
Yes. Yes.
I did a little test of my cartoon club game the other day with my aunt and uncle and niece. And, you know, I played as well. So you might think, well, I teach cartoon club, I'm going to win, right? I said, it's very surprising who wins, quote unquote, wins the game, because it's not the person who draws the best. It's the person who sees the idea and expands out from the idea and uses it in the most creative way, in the funny and witty ways. And that's another thing, like, that is a really big component. And I have a friend when I was going through a bunch of, you know, when you're coming around to like what it is your work is, you expand out, you come up with all kinds of different ideas, right? And you have to narrow these things in. And I also have a tendency to be very serious about things, right? Very, you know. And she said, but what's fun? Like, what's the most fun for you to do? I'm like, fun? Why should I have fun? And I thought, you know, whenever I have one of these really strong judgments, I think that's something I should pay attention to. So I thought, maybe I do need to have more fun. Maybe I need to have more fun, because if you're really going to translate fun, which I want to, you also have to be having fun. And I thought, you know, actually, the cartooning is fun. Mm-hmm. And it's very, a very sort of like freeing way to explore ideas. And that's what really helps in thinking creatively.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. And I think when I first learned about your drawing club or cartooning club, my first thought was, well, I can't draw, so why would I want to even explore that way? But talking with you, I'm excited. Like, I want to sign up. So where do I sign up, Sarah?
Where do you sign up? Yeah. Well, you can find me, everything about me, on my website. So that's sarahjanevickery.com. And there's a tab for Cartoon Club on my website. You can also find me on Facebook. So there's my Sarah Jane Vickery art page, but I've also just started a Cartoon Club group. So I've got a private Cartoon Club group. So if you just go onto Facebook and Google Cartoon Club, you will find our group. So it's small. It's just for sharing, you know, hand drawn cartoons, yours. So you as the adult or your kids. You can be taking class or not taking class. It doesn't matter. It's just about sharing hand-drawn cartoons. So that's what happens in our Cartoon Club group. And I also post up everything that I do from class. So if you want to, you know, see what I do, or, you know, you come to a class and you didn't finish your drawing, you can keep drawing along. So yeah, it's just there as a resource. And I'm also on Instagram. I'm SJ Vickery on Instagram. But those are the main places that you'll find me.
Fantastic. I'll make sure all of those are included in the show notes. Sarah, it has been a pleasure speaking with you today. So fun to hear your journey, and inspiring for parents who might have kids who we know they learn differently, and you're concerned about their success and progress in life. But hearing your story, starting off in remedial grades and being able to turn yourself into an entrepreneur and do so many wonderful things, it shows that we can't put limits on our kids. And the the more we can help support them and stretch them to that next stage, surround them with resources, really take an interest in what they have an interest in. That was your biggest resource consistently. Yeah. What you had an interest in, and even if that's video games, I mean, you know, I think to myself all the time, my 8-year-old, he loves his video games. Well, what is he learning? He's learning a lot about problem solving. He's learning a lot about how to think quickly. And yeah. I can't play a video game. I get so nervous about that. I'm going to get
me neither.
Lose my life. So like he's developing that naturally. And I don't, you know, how does that help him in life later on? I don't know, but I know it's going to.
Yeah. So. I would never have thought. Someone asked me the day, they're like, would you imagine that this is what you'd be doing? I said, never.
Yeah. But that's okay. And you listened, you know, to your intuition at various times in your life in a different fashion, but you kept coming back to that, what you felt motivated by, what created meaning for you in your life. And that's what has driven you to success. So anything else you'd like to tell our listeners today, Sarah?
No, just if they, you know, if they want to try a class, they're welcome to try a class. And we can always pop a link in your description or whatever, because I do sometimes offer out, you know, free classes. So we can do that. That'd be great. Oh, and I do have free resources on my website as well, like free downloads, coloring pages and stuff, and free tutorials on YouTube. So if you know, that's a resource as well. If they want to just have a go at a really simple cartoon, just Google Sarah Jane Vickery on YouTube and you'll find my tutorials too. That stuff's all free. So yeah, that's it. Thank you so much for, you know, for talking with me, and it, you know, it's helped me figure things out too that I never thought about.
Fantastic. Well, I do enjoy talking. That's something, a passion of mine since I was a young child. I love talking. All right, great. You have a super day.
You too. Bye, Christine.